what I think is really important, namely that his study of infant congenital hypothyroidism is the first evidence I know of an adverse health effect in the United States from Fukushima. Now, knowing that he was going to be here, I actually checked with my endocrine colleagues who have a lot of information about this, and they told me that the registries on which he depended are actually quite good and have been in place for quite a bit of time. Now, his data are preliminary. I'm sure they'll be controversial, but in point of fact, I think they are very important. Now, they're based on relatively small numbers, even though statistically significant, and there are a lot of caveats, and it needs a lot of confirmation with larger numbers. All that's true, but it is also true that his data looked very interesting, and if confirmed, could show us clearly that Fukushima is here in the United States. Now, to our session. The first speaker is going to be Cindy Folkers, and she is going to talk about post-Fukushima food monitoring in the United States.
Thank you. Before I begin, good afternoon. Welcome to the post-lunch haze. I want to start out by thanking Dr. Helen Caldicott and Physicians for Social Responsibility for this symposium. It's amazing, and I want the public to know that you are getting information here that would not be readily available to us otherwise, and it's very important information. So thank them from the bottom of my heart. So, just how contaminated is our food? I got this question, alas, a lot of times after Fukushima exploded, and I'm still getting it, and it's frustrating because it doesn't have a good answer. We know that radiation from Fukushima did reach the U.S. directly. Iodine-131, cesium-137 and 134 are evidence of this. Other radioisotopes could have reached us as well, but they're harder to detect. This doesn't make them less important, but my talk will focus on cesium for a number of reasons, which will become clear. Do I need to? A little closer this way, down? How's that? Better? Okay, great. So what needs to be assessed from this point forward is how cesium cycles and becomes concentrated or biomagnified in the environment over the long term, and where it might enter our food supply as a result. Now, remember, our food can come not just from what is grown in the U.S., but what is harvested from the Pacific Ocean and imported from other countries, including Japan. So what are the most important points for understanding radiation in this food monitoring context? Radiation is expelled from the nucleus of an atom and is represented by a unit called a becquerel. One becquerel is equal to one atomic disintegration per second, and different radionuclides give off different kinds of radiation. Different types of radiation are blocked by different substances depending on the density of the substance and the quality of the radiation itself. And certain types of radiation that would be less damaging outside our bodies can become much more damaging if taken internally, inhaled or ingested, since there's nothing inside our cells, like a piece of paper or plexiglass, to block this radioactive energy. In this case, each one of these disintegrations or hits, represented by a becquerel, may cause damage and disease. Also, because some radiation is more easily blocked, like alpha and beta particle radiation, it can be challenging to measure certain radionuclides inside food if this is the only type of radiation that they emit. In general, gamma radiation is easier to measure because it travels through most material more easily, like the flesh of an apple or the flesh of a fish. This makes gamma the obvious choice for testing, because you don't need to do anything extra to the food to prepare it, like cut an apple or pulp the apple. The radionuclide cesium-137 emits a gamma ray, so it is the radionuclide most often measured. But even if you don't find that cesium gamma, it doesn't mean the food doesn't contain other radionuclides that are of concern, like strontium-90, plutonium-239. So obviously measuring food for just gamma has serious limitations, but it would be a reasonable start in any food testing program. Fukushima isn't the only source of cesium contamination. We have been being exposed to man-made radiation for generations from a number of different sources. So atomic bomb blasts worldwide, 954 petabecquerels, I will use quadrillion. And to give you an illustration of what a quadrillion is, if you have a quadrillion pennies on top of each other, they would reach the sun and back five times over. This is a big number. Every nuclear power reactor releases radionuclides to water and air as part of their operating plan. It doesn't take an accident to release this material, although we know they've had plenty of those as well. A total release amount for cesium-134 and 137 is currently unavailable and would have to be calculated for the U.S. nuclear power reactor fleet. It would also be based on questionable effluent release data that is most often collected by industry, not independent parties. Then there's Chernobyl. 85 quadrillion becquerels of cesium-137. This number has a margin of plus or minus 26 petabecquerels. So that's 26 quadrillion becquerels. Fukushima releases to air and ocean. Release of noble gas, unspecified as to what type it was. These numbers are from a TEPCO press release that came out earlier on. And finally, 10 million becquerels of cesium-134 and 137 are still, as far as I know, being released every hour. Now, what these slides have shown us is that we don't have a good idea of just how much cesium has been released or continues to be released. Who's testing? So who's testing our food for man-made radioactivity? Vital Choice and Eden are private companies who pay to have their products tested. Berkeley Nuclear Department ran about 115 total samples. I think all of them were from California. Most were from 2011. FDA, EPA, and DOE have severely curtailed their monitoring since the initial days of the accident. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration was thought to be watching something called the Kuroshio Current, which somebody mentioned yesterday in a presentation. And if the contamination reached this current, they would consider monitoring California coast seawater and sediment. But I don't think they're doing that yet, and I believe the contamination has reached this current, which is like a fast track to the California Pacific coast. These aren't the only universities and institutes that have done testing, but the testing has been limited, it needs more money to continue, and there has been complaining about lack of funding for this very important work. Current and past food testing programs have a number of shortcomings. Most samples are only tested for gamma-emitting radionuclides. Testing has been severely curtailed now, even though Fukushima is still spewing and the contamination is becoming entrenched. EPA was criticized by the Inspector General because 20% of its radiation monitors in the U.S. were out of service when the Fukushima catastrophe began. And a very important point, and I want everyone to hear this, sampling a piece of food every once in a while gives you no real idea of the scope of the contamination or the bioaccumulation and doesn't pinpoint any radiation hotspots that might exist. So in general, testing of U.S. foodstuffs is inadequate. The U.S. limit of 1,200 becquerels per kilogram of just cesium-134 and or 137 is way too high. And it isn't binding, because the FDA can decide to act or not at any level of cesium contamination. So it's exactly like not having a standard at all. Japan, on the other hand, their limit is 100 becquerels per kilogram. Finally, release of info to the public is paltry, if at all. So what have they found so far? California kelp. Iodine levels were significantly higher than before Fukushima. They didn't test it for cesium, and they should. They've asked for funding. I don't know if they've got it. I don't know an update on this, but this is important because kelp provides a food source for fish. So there is concern that contamination from the fish that eat the kelp will be concentrated within the fish. Pistachios grown in California were shipped to a Japanese supermarket. The Japanese supermarket tested 18 becquerels per kilogram of cesium-134 and 137. Beef raised in Japan was tested and approved for market sale and then recalled, but not before it was fed to Japanese school children. All of this beef could have been sold to the U.S., and the FDA may not have pulled it. California grass, 14 becquerels per kilogram, cesium-134 and 137. Grass, like kelp, is the beginning of a potential biomagnification chain which could concentrate cesium in cattle, for instance. And as Berkeley put it on their monitoring site, for understanding the time dependence of food chain results, the grass and soil is what to look at. Green tea, 162 kilograms of it, shipped to France from Japan and rejected because of this level of contamination, 1,038. The U.S. recommendations would have accepted this. Bluefin tuna swam all the way across the Pacific and reached the California coast, retaining cesium-134 and 137. Canada's cesium limit is apparently 1,000 becquerels per kilogram of cesium. And news reports express concern that they will import very contaminated fish from Japan. It is a concern that the U.S. should also share. They were also concerned because contamination was higher in 2012 than it had been in 2011. And this fits with cesium's tendency to biomagnify, but we will have to stay tuned and we should keep measuring ocean fish from the Pacific for cesium. Because of the tendency to biomagnify, in general, we need more testing. And we need to think about how to test over a longer time frame, not just a few years. So how should we think about these contamination levels, and how low should we attempt to make cesium contamination in our food? Remember two things. There's no safe level of radiation. Every exposure does carry some risk, no matter how small. And two, cesium-134 and 137 did not exist in nature before we created and released them. This graph is from ICRP Report 111. ICRP stands for International Commission on Radiological Protection. They recommend how much exposure is okay for humans. Governments follow these recommendations when setting standards. This graph shows us even what are considered very small amounts of cesium, when ingested routinely, can build up to unexpected levels in the body. So it specifically shows that after about 3 years, ingesting 10 becquerels per day of cesium-137 can cause a buildup to over 1,400 becquerels total cesium-137 in your body. For a child who weighs about 30 kilograms, or about 66 pounds, this would be about 50 becquerels per kilogram of cesium-137 in them. And this number is important because in studies of post-Chernobyl Belarus, cardiac abnormalities, heart problems, developed in children whose bodies contain 10 to 30 becquerels per kilogram of cesium. Irreversible myocardiopathologies develop at 50 becquerels per kilogram. Additional pathologies at these low levels can include hormone imbalances, angina, diabetes, and hypertension, which, by the way, are all sort of aging diseases as well. In addition to these diseases, as cesium passes out of your body, its radioactivity starts to damage your kidneys and your bladder, which in turn damages your body's ability to rid itself of the cesium. This could mean that your body could collect cesium more quickly than this graph currently shows, which means the total amount of cesium in your body would be higher over time than this graph shows from chronic ingestion. Why is the U.S. guideline so high? And how about Canada's? Well, it seems to be some sort of official policy to encourage people to accept increasingly radioactive food. Consider this quote also from ICRP Report 111. There may be situations where a sustainable agricultural economy is not possible without placing contaminated food on the market. As such, foods will be subject to market forces. This will necessitate an effective communication strategy to overcome the negative reactions from consumers outside the contaminated areas. So their plan consists not of informing the public that these contamination levels, what the contamination levels are, so that we can decide for ourselves what is and is not appropriate. It consists instead of convincing us that man-made radiation in small doses is not harmful. So what are we going to do about this? Well, Beyond Nuclear, in coalition with other groups that are part of the Fukushima Fallout Awareness Network, or FAN, are in the process of petitioning the Food and Drug Administration of the United States for a binding contamination limit of 5 becquerels per kilogram of cesium-134 and 137. We're also asking for testing of soils and other things. We are asking that the testing be widespread and that the data collected be recorded in a publicly available database, no matter what the cesium contamination level. A database of this information, if constructed properly, could inform research on cesium mobility, biomagnification in the environment, so it could have a broad usefulness, not just for consumers, but for research as well. If you want an easy-to-understand resource on this whole issue, Silence Deafening, Fukushima Fallout, A Mother's Response by Kimberly Roberson speaks to the urgent need for food monitoring, as radiation from nuclear power is now migrating to our homes and kitchens. And of course, I'm with Beyond Nuclear. We have a newsletter. We're going to be having a public petition so that people can sign on this issue. We haven't got it up and running yet. But stick with our website, info@beyondnuclear.org, and you can request our weekly newsletter. So, concluding remarks. When I first started to collect information that would help me recommend a level for cesium contamination in food, and 5 becquerels per kilogram was being bandied about, I wondered if this limit and the testing, that testing most of our food supply, was somehow unreasonable. Through my research, I concluded no, for several reasons. Cesium concentrates or biomagnifies in the environment through natural processes, so diluting it won't save us ultimately. We have to track it and its movements. Historic and continuing cesium releases ensure that generations of humans have now been exposed to it. To what end? What is the damage that has already been done that we may not be able to see? And I'm thinking of multi-generational damage here. Belarus studies show damage at very low levels in children, and ICRP admits that even small amounts of cesium can bioaccumulate in our bodies to this level. There's a lack of publicly available info on cesium levels in food, and we have no reliable estimate on how much has been or is being released. And then finally, they are attempting to convince us everything is fine, despite all that we and they still don't know and all of the uncertainties. And what we do know and what we've seen here in this conference is very, very worrisome. So it isn't just a question anymore of which catastrophe or routine release is to blame for what cesium contamination or any contamination. It's a question of the totality of the radioactive contamination and the damage occurring from it across generations. And cesium is only one of very many radioactive isotopes released. So looking at this evidence, I am now thinking that 5 becquerels per kilogram might still ultimately be too high, but it is a good start to get a handle on what is contaminated, what isn't, and how we move forward. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That was terrific. Next, we're going to hear from Mary Olson, and she's going to talk about gender mattering in the atomic era.
Thank you all for being here. I'm not very good with microphones. Is that okay? Okay. And thank you, Helen, for pulling us all together. It's been really a rich 2 days. I have to start with an apology that I have to leave before question time this afternoon. So I welcome your questions and your networking, and that's my email address. Please be in touch. So here we are, Fukushima plus two. It has a beginning, but quite frankly, in the human frame, it has no end. And prevention is the only cure, to quote my good friends at Physicians for Social Responsibility, who I thank as well for this event. I want to start with some news, though. I got home to email last night and found out that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has permanently denied a license for the very first time ever. I need to acknowledge that it's been multiple organizations, including Beyond Nuclear, but Michael Marriott at Nuclear Information and Resource Service did an incredible job as lead intervener to challenge the license for new reactor construction close to Washington, D.C. So as we ended our session this morning with the view that we need to move from study to protection, I would say, and prevention. And we have just seen an amazing act on the anniversary of Fukushima by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. It is an anomalous point right now, but let's see a build in that direction. That circle is empty and is going to stay that way. So I'm taking a page from some of my colleagues to cut to the chase and get to the point. I'm here to talk to you about gender, and I'm going to unfold this, but many people don't know how to read a graph, and so I want to take just a moment to return to this picture that Stephen Starr gave us yesterday. I want to acknowledge Ian Goddard for creating the graphic, and this information, as we'll talk about more, comes from the National Academy of Sciences Biological Effects of Ionizing Radiation 7, or BIR 7. Again, we'll get there. But look across the bottom. That's the lifespan, 0 to 80. We hope longer, but this graph ends at 80. And look at the vertical. That's increased cancer risk by exposure to a given amount of radiation. And I want to just say that I think that this is a little bit of a fictional story here, but it's a very important pink line and blue line. What is the blue line? The blue line is boys turning to men, turning to old men. What is the pink line? The pink line is little girls turning to women, turning to old women. And if you look at that left-hand part, that is 0 to 5 years lumped together graphically by Ian, but it's actually a five-year group. And it includes pre-birth. And what do we see? We see a striking difference between the blue line and the pink line. Now, Ian added the little green, I don't think I have a pointer here, maybe I do. Anyway, he added the little green circle that's on the 30-year-old male blue line. Because that is what our regulators assume to be the individual who's getting any dose of radiation that we're talking about yesterday and today. All of the radiation we've been talking about assumes that is the individual getting that dose. Whereas this graph really unfolds the entire life cycle of our species if you want to take these numbers. And these numbers are suspect. But how suspect are they? Are we going to flush a 100% difference between 0 and 5, between the blue line and the pink line? Are we going to ignore it completely? And even at the point of the green circle, this graph is a little bit off, I think, because there's a 40 to 60% difference between adult males and adult females. So I'm about to move fairly quickly through a bunch of pictures that are going to be very interlaced with others you've seen. Hopefully you take that as very confirmatory that we are, as a community, are seeing a lot of the same stuff. But I do want to just acknowledge that this level of radiation exposure is the same one that we call 2 REMS in the United States, that is the limit for atomic workers. And also the amount of radiation that the Japanese officials have said it's okay for school children to get while they're in school in the contaminated areas of Japan. Not even the amount that they're getting total at home and going back and forth and playing outside, just the amount that they would get while they're in school. So it's called low dose. In my book, it's not very low. So that graph tells us something. It tells us that one rad does not fit all. We've known for a long time that primary germ cells in the embryo are far more vulnerable. We heard about that today. The fetus, children, their cells are dividing much more rapidly. Their bodies are smaller. Alice Stewart taught us that elders have a bump up in their vulnerability as well. Their repair mechanisms maybe aren't working as much. Some genotypes. We have a whole oncology field that's now tied to what is your DNA. And we know that some people are more likely to get radiologically caused cancers. And now we have to add to that list a gender difference, that females, both juvenile and adult, are more sensitive. So it matters who gets the radiation, not just how long, not just how much, not just what kind. And ultimately, I think this does raise the question of what do we mean by dose? But what I mean by being here is to stand and say it's time to stop letting Monday be the only driver. Let's kick Wall Street out of the decision-making role. I'm being a knowledge translator, I'm being an activist, but we have to collectively, as a society, move towards prevention and precaution as the basis of policy. And I believe that means we have to get a whole lot more women motivated to get involved. Sadly, it's too late for prevention for a lot of what we're seeing. And I think that slide that talked about cesium from the weapons test is incredibly important in this picture. But I got to say the other names: Hiroshima, Nagasaki, weapons test, Kishtim, Windscale, Santa Susana, Three Mile Island, Chernobyl, and Fukushima. Are there others that we don't even know about? This is that big release. 2 days in between each of these reconstructions, Chernobyl, from April 26, 1986 to May 8, 1986, resulting in that 10 days in 40% of Europe having cesium contamination above the 4,000 becquerel per square meter level. And we've heard, you don't need an accident. Every single facility in the nuclear fuel chain puts this stuff out. Now, we say, well, you can't see radiation, but you can see radiation's harm. We've seen it a number of times. This is very high doses of radiation burn, but you can see it with a microscope. These are abnormal chromosomes. This is tissue in the lung that's being damaged by alpha particles. This is cell membranes that have been destroyed and more abnormal chromosomes. This is schematic drawing projection of several different types of damage to DNA, including the double strand that is so hard to fix and results in so many problems. We've heard it. I'm going to say it again. No safe dose. And furthermore, it only takes a single emission from a single radioactive nucleus and that hitting a single cell to have the potential for a fatal cancer. A dose so small you cannot measure it can kill somebody. Does it do it every time? Of course not. We have incredible repair mechanisms. We live in a diverse series of events, but yes. One can equal none. It's not a folk song. EPA standards say there's no safe dose. NRC bases Part 20 and ALARA on no safe dose. NAS reports from Beer 1 through 7 affirm no safe dose. And most of all, we've seen the data. We've seen it. So if we start with a standard man, that little green round place, first, the medical community was protecting itself. Then the health physicists, who was Carl Morgan standing here 12 years ago, who said, we are all health physicists if we are concerned about radiation. They were sending military and paramilitary into very defined places in the Manhattan Project, into radiological zones that were small. Those standards were written for that purpose, and now they are being generalized to everybody, everywhere, all the time. And I need to draw to your attention, not that upper circle that looks so fascinating, the lower circle. The lower circle is where we see that in 100 years, we have increased the radiological experience of our species by 25%. 100 years ago, we didn't have industrial nuclear facilities. So that's why I can say that. 25%. Think of other environmental parameters going up like that. Now, I'm not saying that this represents reality. It's total fiction as to who's getting what. But still, collectively, our institutions are telling us that we've done that. Here is the picture of how it travels through our environment, and it's an honest picture because it shows the man, the standard man. And I just am bringing Rosalie in because it was about 4 years ago that I started getting questions in my public talks about radiation impacting women disproportionately. And I called Rosalie because I couldn't find anything about this, and I was kind of embarrassed. I was 18 years into this work, and I'd never heard this, and where did it come from? And it was Rosalie who said, well, look at this. Well, that was out of print. I called her back. She said, go into Beer 7. It's not in the text. You'll have to look at the numbers. It's in the numbers. And so I did my own independent analysis of the famous report. And I think Steve Wynn gave us very strong cautionary words today, that this report is based largely on the Hiroshima Nagasaki A-bomb survivors. It's largely that lifespan study that he says is deficient in so many ways. It calls to question many things. But I want to point out is we're not talking only about breast cancer. When I talk about women and cancer, everybody assumes I'm talking about breast cancer. It includes breast cancer, but it is the full range of cancers in which these tables show this result. Those are the lifespan ones. I want to acknowledge Dr. Arjun Makajani has an Institute for Energy and Environmental Research, and he has a campaign called Healthy from the Start that's based on that lifespan projection. But I spent a lot of time with this lifetime attributable risk table, and this is the one that talks about the adults. And I wrote this paper and published it in October 2011. And took it around to all the agencies and was amazed to find that at ICRP, I had applause from the audience when I gave a 5-minute version of the paper. And they are actually beginning to work on this, oh, by the way. So real people, my son, my sweetheart, me, a little girl who's gone, and her friend, 2 guys, 3 girls, that's the ratio overall. 2 guys get cancer, 3 girls. 2 guys die of cancer, 3 girls. So why isn't it in the text of the report? Maybe it doesn't come up statistically? Well, Arjun Makajani says it does. Maybe there weren't enough women involved. I don't know. But the generalizations about radiation are based on men. And when we take those assumptions solely, we have an underestimate of harm for women. And in the Nuclear Regulatory Commission regulations, that's about a 40% at least underestimation for the harm to women. And that means an overall underestimation of radiation harm since we're about half the population. So it could be dismissed, it could be just, oh well, we forgot about it. But we are talking about every single female on the planet and every source of ionizing radiation from what I can tell, because we really haven't looked. So why not cast the net that big? We need to look. And by the way, there are now beginning to be animal studies in which these findings are also supported. So I need to wrap up, but I want to mention that the first big agency to put out real sort of, yeah, okay, females are more affected, is this recent report from the World Health Organization. I think it's a deeply flawed report. I don't have time to critique it other than to point out the icons. The first icon below the words is clearly an earthquake. The next icon is clearly a tsunami. And the third icon is clearly a pressurized water reactor that was not at Fukushima. So take that as a sign that you cannot apply what is in this report to necessarily reflecting reality. But it's an important moment where the World Health Organization is saying that there is a difference between males and females. They're saying 70% higher risk of thyroid cancer for little girls exposed below the age of 5 in that 0 to 5 age group. So quickly, ionizing radiation comes from outside our body. I believe there's a huge difference when it comes inside our body, and the Beer 7 report only looks at external. This book, which we've been all talking about, Alexei Yablokov has been with us, does factor internal exposure. There's this famous picture showing that radiation goes to different parts of our body, but the real point I want to make is that once it's in there, there's zero distance to the point of exposure, so the doses are extremely high. And the other thing is that external beta goes in about 1 centimeter. External alpha bounces off. There's zero exposure. And so the difference between an alpha particle in the body and not in the body is basically infinite, but when they compare it to an X-ray, it's anywhere from 7 times more damaging to findings that are 1,000 times more damaging. So if you're inhaling and ingesting radioactivity, if there's alpha particles present, they're really not reflected in the BIR-7 report. So that's another piece that we need to factor in here. Okay, wrapping up, I want to just go to this last slide. Disproportionate harm from ionizing radiation to females raises many issues. All are worthy of engagement. There's medical questions, there's ethical questions, there's historical, occupational, political, legal, evolutionary, and policy and regulation. It's my belief that we need to protect first and study second, but when it comes to the study, there are a bunch of places we could start. Probably not with body mass, because 0 to 5 age group, boys and girls are about the same. But Rosalie thought maybe it's the percentage of reproductive tissue. Someone else said maybe it's the proportion of fatty tissue. Maybe there are metabolic differences. Maybe it's selection, which is long-term environmental. Maybe it's lifestyle, which is short-term environmental. Hard to factor that last one with the 0 to 5 age group, though. And then finally, there are animal studies that are supporting this. So protect first, study second, but as we study, this is an important question, and I do not know of any major program addressing it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Now, third speaker is going to be Kevin Camps, and he's going to talk about 70 years of our radioactive risks in Japan and the United States.
Good afternoon, everybody. Thanks so much to Helen and Molly for this event. It's a real honor to speak here. Yep, and apologies if I rush through, especially slides that echo what others have previously presented. But I've got a lot of ground to cover, as you can see from the title. So I found this image really striking. This is an image from Hiroshima after the bombing, actually, but I just found it so remarkably similar to the post-tsunami scenes that we all remember from 2 years ago. And of course, the comment has been made that even by the likes of the Prime Minister of Japan at the time, that the events of March 11th, 2011 are similar in magnitude and importance as things like the Hiroshima atomic bombing to the Japanese nation. So this is a view of Fukushima Daiichi before the catastrophe began. And I was invited on a speaking tour of Japan in August of 2010, 7 months before the catastrophe. And I stood on a bluff over the Pacific that looked down on Fukushima Daiichi. My first stop was Okuma and Futaba on the speaking tour. So 3.5 miles to the north, I could see the 6 reactors like this. And 3.5 miles to the south from where I stood, I could see the Daini nuclear power plant with 4 reactors. And it's little known, but a single off-site power line is what saved Daini, more operating reactors than at Daiichi, from a similar catastrophe. Several off-site power lines were lost to the earthquake. The emergency diesel generators were lost to the tsunami. And that was the kind of scenario that Prime Minister Kan, his, at the time, Chief Cabinet Secretary Adano, admitted to the Rebuild Japan Initiative Foundation, and the headlines came out on the first anniversary of the Fukushima catastrophe. They feared a demonic chain reaction of atomic reactor meltdowns and pool fires. 6 reactors, well, 3 operating at Daiichi, but 7 pools at Daiichi, 4 operating reactors at Daini and 4 pools, 1 reactor and 1 pool at Tokai, closer to Tokyo. And that's where the headlines came from about the possibility of having to evacuate Tokyo if that worst case scenario had played out. 30 million people. But something that the filmmaker Kurosawa envisioned in his film Dreams in 1990 in the part called Mount Fuji in Red, atomic reactors exploding behind Mount Fuji as seen from Tokyo. So here are the explosions at the Unit 1 and the Unit 3. And the aftermath in mid-March of 2011. But it's not the first time, and I should mention that the reactors, of course, are General Electric Mark I boiling water reactors, so there's an instant tie between this Japanese catastrophe and U.S. involvement. But of course, our nuclear involvement, so to speak, goes back 70 years. And we just held a conference in Chicago to mark the 70th year since Enrico Fermi fired up the first atomic reactor in the world, the Chicago Pile 1, as part of the Manhattan Project, the race for the bomb. So you can see an image, an artist's rendition of the pile there. And this is Enrico Fermi. And the title of the conference was A Mountain of Radioactive Waste 70 Years High. So, of course, this was all about the bomb. And these are images of the mushroom clouds at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And so the radioactive risks began with the bomb project. And I should have mentioned that Enrico Fermi took a calculated risk, or maybe it was an uncalculated risk, at the University of Chicago. The original plan was to build that prototype reactor some 20 miles, 30 miles outside of town, where argon is now located. And there was no time. They couldn't do it in time, so they decided to just do it at the University of Chicago. They didn't even inform the president of the university. They're doing this on the edge of downtown Chicago, and Fermi convinced his higher-ups that probably it would be okay. But some of his graduate students were assigned the task of what they called the suicide squad, and this was to pour a chemical solution onto the pile if something went wrong. There was another individual called the safety control rod axe man, who literally with his axe would chop a rope that was over a pulley and drop the control rod into the out-of-control reactor. And that term, scram, still sticks in the nuclear power industry. But as we saw at Fukushima Daiichi, you can scram a reactor when a 9.0 earthquake strikes, but the decay heat is enough to melt it down if you can't cool the cores. So again, with the history, we see Oppenheimer and Groves at the Trinity blast site. This was the precursor to the Nagasaki plutonium bomb and the aftermath of that shown. They didn't have to test the uranium bomb. It was sure to work, so they didn't test it. But, you know, as has been mentioned by Dr. Fairley and Mary Olson, the fallout from the Cold War, atomic bomb tests and hydrogen bomb tests. And this next section, Brian Victoria is right in the front row, so I owe a debt of gratitude to Professor Victoria because I learned history coming to Antioch University Midwest last Earth Day last year that I hadn't known about the early U.S. involvement in the Japanese nuclear power industry. So, atomic weapons testing in the Pacific. In mid-March of 2011, I happened to catch one of the episodes of CBS Evening News with Katie Couric, and it was about Fukushima that day, and they showed these images on the right of the USS Ronald Reagan crew swabbing the decks in radiation protection gear because of being blanketed from Fukushima. And it just harkened back to these images from as early as 1946. And granted, that's a photo op. You can see the sailors are smiling, but they bore the brunt of that health damage over the years and decades after that. They are the atomic veterans. So the atom bomb testing going on in the Pacific, a Cold War arms race with the Soviets well underway, and President Eisenhower gives a speech called Atoms for Peace at the United Nations in the early 1950s. And Arjun Makajani at IEER has written just an incredible book, if you haven't read it. It's called The Nuclear Power Deception. It came out in 1999, and I learned a lot about the propaganda machine, which was Atoms for Peace. Because uranium mining and milling and processing and enrichment all had to be expanded for this arms race we were in with the Soviets. But how to sell that to the American people? Well, Atoms for Peace. It put a smiley face facade on this major expansion of all things nuclear. And remember, this is the early 1950s. The first so-called civilian atomic reactor was not fired up in Shippingport, Pennsylvania, under the direction of the head of the nuclear navy. So it's a civilian project, but it's a nuclear submarine reactor built on land, just to get it going. A lot, or even most, or even all of the uranium in this country that was being milled, being mined and milled and processed and enriched was feeding the arms race for not years, but decades, until the commercial industry started to really show up in the 1970s. And then the uranium supply started to shift over somewhat to fuel those reactors. So this, again, the history that I learned from Brian Victoria, Castle Bravo was a Castle was a series of hydrogen bomb tests that the United States carried out at places like Bikini. And on March 1st of 1954, the Bravo test got a little out of control. Edward Teller was involved in designing this bomb, as were other scientists, and they miscalculated the yield of this explosion. They expected a 5-megaton blast, and they got more like a 15-megaton blast. And it still is the worst radiological contamination incident in the history of U.S. nuclear weapons testing. And this Japanese tuna fishing boat, the Lucky Dragon number 5, was unfortunately not very far away. You can see in the map on the right there, the blast, Bikini, marked by a B, the Lucky Dragon marked by the F. They were outside of the zone that the United States had declared off limits. But then later, they redrew the danger zone, and they were well within that danger zone. And over time, half of the crew of 23 died of their radiation exposures. One of the deaths occurred pretty quickly, within a matter of months, and it led to an anti-nuclear groundswell in Japan, including a petition drive with many tens of millions of signatures against atomic bomb tests and against hydrogen bomb tests, and 1 million signatures alone from Hiroshima area. And the United States became very worried because there was this large groundswell of opposition to the nuclear energy establishment. And there were fears that even the Soviet Union or China could take advantage of this situation, and it's in the competition for loyalties after World War II. So again, the juxtaposition of images old and new. So on the left, officials from the city of Tokyo testing the tuna from the Lucky Dragon and finding severe contamination. But like Cindy talked about, some of that tuna had already been sold, had already been consumed before it was quarantined. And then on the right, this is actually an image from Thailand, not from Japan, but also dealing with the contamination of seafood post-Fukushima. And this was brand new to me that I learned from my visit to Antioch. So a part of the United States response to try to shore up Atoms for Peace was to actually deploy the Central Intelligence Agency to Japan. And this individual on the left is Louis Strauss, the head of the Atomic Energy Commission. And the Atomic Energy Commission took a lead role in downplaying the significance of the food contamination in Japan. And this individual on the right, Shiriki, a fascinating story compared to Citizen Kane of Japan, a media mogul who controlled one of the largest newspapers, one of the largest television stations in Japan, had higher ambitions for political office, was a founder of the Liberal Democratic Party of Japan. And in 2006, it was documented that he was working with the Central Intelligence Agency under a couple code names. And one of his assignments was to sell nuclear power to the Japanese people, and he did it with a passion. And so the infamous nuclear village was born, and this image is just one example. The speaker from the investigation by the Japanese parliament showed other images of the propaganda used. This is a plutonium boy, and of course these are geared for children. And so exhibits were shown across the country just as they were here in the United States, traveling exhibits. And during my time in Japan in 2010, I went to one of these kind of Disneyland-like experiences at a nuclear power plant, which are really geared for young children. And one of the first companies to take advantage of this situation was company that Mr. Shiriki worked with, and that was General Dynamics, that got in early on the nuclear business in Japan. But General Electric was not too far behind. So here's, a grand total of about 140 atomic reactors in the U.S. 104 are still operating, but you got to take off Crystal River, Florida, 103 now. Take off Kewaunee, Wisconsin, 102. Sorry that Canada is not on the map because there are, 20-plus reactors in Canada, but take off Jeanty 2 in Quebec. So there are dominoes on the brink of tipping over, and we need to shut them down before they melt down. This is Atomic Japan, third only to the United States, and then France with 58 reactors, Japan with 54, plus Manju, the fast breeder reactor. One of the places in Japan, Fukui Prefecture, a remarkable number of reactors, more than a dozen, along a short stretch of coastline. And what I want to do for the next section of the talk is just go through the parallels between U.S. and Japanese nuclear history in terms of accidents, incidents. They're remarkably parallel. And what I took was just an arbitrary list. The Associated Press, shortly after the beginning of the Fukushima catastrophe, put a list of, a short list of 10 or so Japanese nuclear accidents that had already occurred before Fukushima. So I took that list, because it could be much longer, and I compared it to ones here in North America. So you see on the left Suruga nuclear power plant, but you see on the right the Bruce nuclear power plant in Ontario. This is worker overexposures. So in 1981, 300 workers were exposed to excessive levels of radiation after a fuel rod ruptured at Suruga. And it reminded me of an incident in Michigan at Big Rock Point, an experimental atomic reactor, where a MOX fuel rod was broken in the 1970s and 700,000 curies of radioactivity were released. But Bruce is also on the Great Lakes in Canada. And just recently, in 2009, there was an exposure of hundreds of workers to alpha particle radiation when they were grinding through contaminated pipes. They had no respiratory protection on. And before moving on from the Bruce slide, I just wanted to mention that this is one of the biggest nuclear power plants, certainly in North America. It's the biggest, and even in the world. There's a total of 9 reactors on this site. They're even proposing a low and intermediate level radioactive waste dump for all of Ontario's 20 reactors worth of waste, a burial site, 400 yards from the water of Lake Huron. But there are a half dozen communities, mostly populated by Bruce workers, that want to be the high-level radioactive waste dump for all of Canada. And the Great Lakes is 20% of the world's surface fresh water, drinking water supply for 40 million people in North America. So this next parallel is sodium fires. And you see Manju in Fukui Prefecture suffered a bad sodium fire in 1995. Videotape footage of the damage was concealed for a time and then later got released. But Fermi Unit 1 in Monroe County, Michigan, suffered a sodium fire, suffered tritium leaks in 2008. And what's remarkable about that is it had permanently shut down in 1972. These were decommissioning accidents at Fermi 1. Fermi 1 was made famous or infamous by an October 5th, 1966 partial meltdown of the reactor core, captured in the book We Almost Lost Detroit. So talk about a cover-up. That was a 10-year cover-up of a partial meltdown in Michigan until John Fuller wrote this book. The next parallels, reprocessing plant fires and explosions. Now, this is a lesser-known accident at Tokai Mura in Japan. March 11th, 1997, ironically the same date as the later Fukushima catastrophe. And 40 workers were exposed to radiation in this reprocessing. Yeah, I've got a problem because I can't see my notes on this screen. So the parallel in the United States is right here in the state of New York at West Valley near Buffalo, a commercial reprocessing facility that operated from 1966 to 1972. But they had so many fires and leaks and worker overexposures at West Valley that they only did 1 year's worth of reprocessing throughput. They also did military reprocessing at that site. And the cleanup bill at West Valley is between $10 and $27 billion. And it's not even hardly begun. And if they do not clean that site up, it is going to erode into Lakes Erie and Ontario over time. So it has to be cleaned up. So the more infamous nuclear disaster at Tokaimura was the inadvertent criticality of 1999. Two workers died from their radiation exposures. And another inadvertent criticality took place in 1999, but again, the truth was covered up for 8 years, and it wasn't known that there had been a 30-minute, I believe, criticality in the reactor core. Sorry, 15 minutes. And a similar thing had happened at Fermi Unit 2, which I'll show in this slide. Fermi 2, which is the biggest General Electric Mark I boiling water reactor in the world, same design as Fukushima Daiichi, only as big as Units 1 and 2 at Fukushima Daiichi put together. They had an inadvertent criticality in 1985. And the watchdog, Michael Keegan, with Don't Waste Michigan, outed it, and it kept that reactor shut down for 3 years because they didn't have a permit to run the reactor. They just did it accidentally. Luckily, no one was hurt. So the safety cover-ups continued. Tokyo Electric Power Company, the book about Tokyo Electric is called Dark Empire. So it starts to capture their behavior. So in 2000, three TEPCO executives were forced to resign after the revelation that in 1989, the company had ordered an employee to edit out footage showing cracks in nuclear plant steam pipes in video that was shown to regulators. Of course, they eventually were allowed to restart their reactors. And there was another cover-up in Japan that was outed by the Japanese anti-nuclear movement. Eileen Miyoko-Smith at Green Action told me this story. The British Nuclear Fuel Limited mocks fuel supply with falsified quality assurance figures, that it took tremendous efforts to document this, but they did, that those were falsified figures. They simply photocopied the results of earlier batches, so to speak, cut and paste, which caused a huge delay in the plutonium thermal loading in Japan. So another cover-up I want to mention here in the United States is Davis-Besse, Ohio, which had a massive corrosion hole in the lid of the reactor in 2002 and operated to within 3/16 of an inch of breaching the lid through nearly 7 inches of carbon steel. And again, cover-ups. Video footage was edited before the NRC was allowed to see it. This photograph, though, the NRC had in its possession, still did not take action. This is a lava stream, so to speak, of boric acid crystals and rust coming off of the lid. And the former NRC chairman, Richard Meserve, his fingerprints are all over this near disaster. Junior inspectors at NRC wanted to shut the plant down, inspect, see what was going on. Meserve and other senior management at NRC allowed the reactor to operate to the brink of disaster. And the Office of Inspector General at NRC later reported that NRC had prioritized company profits over public safety. Meserve resigned shortly after that report, and unfortunately is still brought to Tokyo, as in December, for consultation on nuclear safety matters. He also is the chairman of all things nuclear at the National Academy of Science, even though he serves on two for-profit nuclear utility corporate boards, Pacific Gas and Electric in California and Comanche in Texas. And through grassroots activism, was forced to recuse himself from the current radiation study on cancer incidents associated with nuclear power plants in the United States. So more examples of the close parallels between the U.S. and Japan. There have been not radioactive, but steam accidents where workers have been killed. So at Mihama Unit 3 in Fukui, again, four workers were killed after a steam explosion. The subsequent investigation revealed a significant lack of systematic inspections at Japanese nuclear power plants. Surrey in Virginia, which David Lochbaum mentioned yesterday, may have cleaned up its act a bit after two separate steam fatality accidents. One killed two workers in 1972. Another one killed four workers in 1986. And that's the single largest loss of life at a nuclear power plant in the United States. Surrey's also infamous because they're experimenting with dry cask storage out there. They have a real smorgasbord of different cask models, and they've had problems. They've had leaks of the inerting heat transfer gas out of one seal, perhaps out of a second seal. It hasn't leaked completely out, But if it does, oxygen can get in, the waste can overheat, and you can have corrosion of deterioration of the fuel inside. So this slide is about radioactive steam releases. Now, these are not scalding people to death, but they do contain radioactivity that then leaves the site. Daiichi had such an incident in 2006. A really controversial one was the January 2012 steam release from a failed steam generator tube at San Onofre in Southern California. The two units at San Onofre are still shut down, 14 months now, due to a faulty design and fabrication of steam generator replacements, which cost $617 million. And for details on that, Arnie Gunderson is the expert witness for Friends of the Earth on this matter, and hopefully those reactors will never start up again. There's a groundswell of anti-nuclear activism in Southern California to keep them shut down. So earthquake risks. Before Daiichi, there was the 2007 quake, ironically on the Trinity atomic blast anniversary at Kajiwazaki Kariwa, which is the largest nuclear power plant in the world, seven large-scale reactors, some of which had begun to come back to service, but then the 2011 earthquake catastrophe, of course, has shut down all operable reactors in Japan except for two in Fukui Prefecture at the Oi nuclear power plant. Earthquake risks at Indian Point. Indian Point happens to be located immediately adjacent to earthquake faults that were not known about when it was constructed. And seismologists at Columbia University confirmed their existence in 2008, and the NRC has been forced to admit that this is probably the most vulnerable nuclear power plant in the country to earthquake risks because it wasn't built that well. Granted, Diablo Canyon and San Onofre are still vulnerable to earthquakes and tsunamis, but they were built more strongly because there was a recognition the San Andreas was right there. Indian Point, they had no such appreciation. And this image shows Indian Point in the distant background on the Hudson River, and Mrs. Sashiko Sato, a Fukushima organic farmer, Eileen Miyoko Smith from Green Action, and also an organic farmer from Hokkaido, and another leader of the anti-nuclear movement in Hokkaido, we went up to visit the Indian Point Safe Energy Coalition folks. That was September 2012. So this is just the cover of the New Yorker, another haunting image from March of 2011 that was published on the date of the Three Mile Island anniversary, actually, March 28th. And so I just wanted to go to some additional risks that weren't mentioned in that AP article from March of 2011 in Japan and their parallels in the U.S., reactor pressure vessel embrittlement, the neutron bombardment of the 8-inch or so metal walls of a reactor pressure vessel over years and decades, and the impurities in the metal creating cracks which can line up, and if the emergency core cooling systems are ever activated, the final line of defense to prevent a meltdown, the thermal shock of the temperature decrease combined with the high pressure can crack these vessels. And if that happens, it would be an irreparable loss of coolant accident. There's no contingency in place. So the worst in Japan, the worst in the United States, another Entergy atomic reactor, just like Indian Point. Risks that have been mentioned are the high-level radioactive waste storage pools that are not located in radiological containment structures. Bob Alvarez talked about that much better than I can. We're having headlines about leaks at Hanford, and the irony of this is it harkens back 70 years, really, because Hanford generated the plutonium for the Nagasaki atomic bomb, continued to for the Cold War arsenal. Well, those high-level radioactive waste liquid and sludge storage tanks, the single-shelled ones, when they leak, it's directly into the environment. The first double shell had a leak in August. Granted, it's between the walls of the two shells and not out yet, but it shows there's problems. Leaks at high-level radioactive waste storage pools in the United States. There are more than a half dozen pools in the U.S. that have documented leaks. Indian Point's pool leak is ongoing as we speak. Brookhaven's is very significant because millions of people drink the water in the aquifer under Long Island. So fault solutions, a big fight that's coming our way, centralized interim storage. They want to put the waste onto the roads, the rails, the waterways, including the Hudson River, is possibly targeted for 58 barge shipments of high-level radioactive waste from Indian Point down to the port of Jersey City to get it to parking lot dumps, whether at a place like Savannah River site on the right here, or waste isolation pilot plant in New Mexico, or Native American reservations out west. All for what? To create a shell game on the roads and rails and waterways, because if it goes to a parking lot dump for 50 years, it may have to go right back to where it came from for permanent disposal. It accomplishes nothing except transfer of liability onto the American taxpayer from the utilities that profited from the generation. I mentioned the good news at Kewaunee of shutdown. The only two reactors in Japan currently operating are these, OE, but the other 48 operable reactors in the country are not operating, and it's a real testament to the Japanese people and anti-nuclear movement. A lot of this has already been talked about by previous speakers, the 1972 warnings that the Mark I was a catastrophically flawed reactor. The GE3 blew the whistle in 1976. Also in 1986, the NRC's point man at Three Mile Island warned about the Mark I. So we have a campaign at Beyond Nuclear called Freeze Our Fukushimas. In the immediate aftermath of the Fukushima catastrophe beginning, we prioritize the Mark I's and Mark II's. If we can't shut these down for safety risks, then, you know, what can we shut down after Fukushima? The Japanese parliament identified collusion between regulator and industry as the root cause of the Fukushima catastrophe. We have collusion in spades in the United States between the nuclear power industry, and here are four of the five NRC commissioners. They are poised to pass a majority vote against putting filters on the vents at the Mark I's and Mark II's, bowing to pressure from industry and from House Republicans. So Gene Stilp, who's a watchdog on Three Mile Island, a survivor of the accident, lives in Harrisburg, showed up in Michigan in 1999 with a banner that said, Three Mile Island, this is a Bob Del Tredici photo, Chernobyl, and he said, where next? And of course, we have to add Fukushima to the list, and we again have to ask, where next? We have to shut them down before they melt down. Thank you.